Morning, birds. Hey, what a show we have for today. It's pretty cool. Well, we have it's an interesting combination of stuff. This is a day we're going to talk about mushrooms. We have an expert on mushrooms. I know, very interesting stuff. And oddly enough, this is the anniversary of when the Beatles released Magical Mystery Tour, which was an era when a lot of us were experts on mushrooms. Ready, let's go back.
The letter is our fine stuff I bring to Edmund Allen Duff. Keep your mouth upon that.
1967. Wow. They released Magical Mystery Tour. did the Beatles. That's a Wiggy record. We all listen to that. And like many of the Beatles LPs, it just has a lot of hit songs on it. So we'll get to that. And a lot of other stuff today. It's 5 after the hour. This is Pandemic Pirate Radio from Chicago on Bleat.network. And yeah, we got a mushroom expert on today. Honest to God, a mycologist. Why? We'll tell you. So hang on for that. Let's hit the news real quick. The headline's not so good today. United States has passed 250,000 fatalities from the COVID. Dr. Anthony Fauci said the nation needed a uniform approach to fend off the onslaught, but there has been a notable lack of national direction. These are the New York Times headlines. New York City parents scrambling after learning that public schools they're going to shut down in New York. And in Japan, they went on a maximum alert in an effort to prevent infections. The spread of the virus, I guess this is a little bit of a good news moment. Spread of the virus in Europe appears to be slowing. That's according to a World Health Organization official. So that's cooking well. I'm going to quote Apple News here because I think that's kind of important here. They're telling you that the Joe Biden transition team has tried to project calm as President Donald Trump refuses to concede, and many Republicans and even one key part of the federal government, we'll talk about that in a second, continue to have his back. Behind the scenes, Biden's advisors are in the midst of a fierce lobbying blitz to get Trump's allies to crack their dispatching emissaries from past administrations, Republican and Democrat, along with a wide array of businesses and interest group leaders to intercede on Biden's behalf. According to 3 transition officials, this is Politico I'm reading from here, Biden's team is in talks with multiple Republican leaders and office holders to end the transition stalemate, warning them of risks to national security and public health if the president-elect isn't granted access to the government. Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris are also deploying aides and allies to ramp up public pressure on General Services Administrator Emily Murphy. I'm going to try to call her. Do you mind? Biden's roster of medical experts is making the rounds on cable TV to argue that the transition needs to get underway now. There you go. So, what they identify in one of these bits of news here, a little-known government agency. And let's rip the lid off that. The General Services Administration is an independent agency of the United States government. It was established in 1949. Here's what they do. You know, every organization has an office manager. All right, the United States government has an office manager, and that's called the General Services Administration, the GSA. That's what they do. They make sure that people have a place to work. They rent offices. They lease stuff like that. And the problem is that Emily W. Murphy is the current General Services Administrator, and she was appointed by anybody? Trump? It was Trump. Yes, it was Trump. And she will just not give up the keys to the car. So what's going on here? Have you ever replaced somebody at a job? You know what I'm talking about. All right. You go in. Betty has left a few of her files there. She's going to take them with them. You know, she's got the cleaning products on her desk. And some of the files from the office stay there, and then you walk in with your thing. That's what we're trying to do in Washington here. And the Trumpsies are not allowing that to happen. So what are we going to do about that? I don't know. I think there might be some sort of an intercession at some point, an intervention. The whole world is going, ha, ha, ha. You know what I think I'm going to do here? Do you mind? I thought I'd just see if we could, let me see here. I don't know. I mean, they work for us, do they not? Let's call the GSA right here. This is in Washington. Let me see if Emily Murphy is up. Let me think.
You have reached the U.S. General Services Administration. Okay. For global supply order questions or general questions related to GSA products and schedules, press 1. For travel, press 2.
That's
for GSA Smart Pay Program or government charge card questions, press 3. For contractor questions on billing, contract modifications, using GSA Advantage, GSA eBuy, or other GSA applications, press 4.
Mm-hmm.
For USA.gov support, press 5.
Yeah.
For the public building service industry relations, press 6. For GSA payroll services branch, press 7.
Ooh.
For all other matters, please visit us at www.gsa.gov.
I'm going to hit 1.
To repeat this menu,
no,
press 0.
Repeat it, yeah. Here we go. This is 1 here.
Wait while I transfer your call.
All right. We'll see what we got here.
Thank you for calling my GSA customer center. My name is Shirley. How may I assist you today?
Shirley, my name's Gary Lee Wright. I'm calling from a radio show in Chicago this morning. We're just trying to get a scoop on what's happening at the GSA. Is there a public statement that you can make for us? Or I'm just reading a news story on how we haven't allowed the person that I personally voted for to take office because of the GSA. What can you tell me about that? Are you authorized to give me a statement?
Not authorized to give you a statement, and unfortunately don't have any information that was given to me to provide to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because of GSA, a big organization, my department here, we just filter out calls. So we don't actually know what's really going on with the transitional letter or anything. Only thing I can do is log your call in that you call and send it to my higher echelon, and that is about as much as I can do.
All right. Well, listen, I appreciate it.
So unfortunately, I'm in the dark just like you and everything. And stuff.
Yeah, listen, ma'am, I didn't call you to pull your tail here. You're a hardworking government employee, and I think you're probably doing everything that you can do. So, tell them that Gary Lee Wright from the Bleat.network called. We just want to know what's cooking in Washington.
And what network you in, too?
It's Bleat, B-L-E-A-T, Bleat Network. And tell them that we want to know what's going on. And personally, I would like to wish you a good day.
Well, you too as well. Thank you, Gary. I appreciate it. Happy holidays.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Oh, God. You know what the thing is? This woman, she wants to open up the business again. You got that, did you not? Yes, you did. All right. Did I mention that sometimes all you need is love.
Nothing you can do that can't be done. Nothing you
We can fix this. All you need is love and a pipe wrench. Just threw that in. 17 after the hour, it's the Pandemic Pirate Radio Show from Chicago. 19th of November, today is Thursday. You know, I am glad that we just did. That was a live phone call. I hadn't prepared to do that, and why not? We called up. Because, you know what? These people, by and large, that work for the government before the Trumpsies came in are great. They do a good job, and they are they're working for us. They are paid by taxes, and I'm glad that we had a chance to chat with that woman this morning. Microphone Jones came in during that. MJ, you there, sir?
Good morning.
She sounded like she was good. I think she wanted to say, okay, based on your call, Gary, I'll let him know to give Biden the stuff. So anyway.
Yeah, it definitely was shocking.
Yeah.
I didn't think that phone call was going to go the way that it went.
I know. Well, you know, I just think that we are in those weird times here. So anyway, speaking of a way to maybe connect all these things, President-elect Biden, as people may know, has announced that they have brought a rescue dog to the White House, which is a good thing, you know, because a couple of years ago they purchased a dog and then he was kind of criticized for. Mm-hmm. From like, you know, you don't want to do these puppy breeding mills. That wasn't what it was. Anyway, so I want to go. This is not a history of veterinary science. I'm just trying to get to the pointer. So anyway, the Bidens apparently have a rescue dog in, and we're excited about that. So anyway, MJ, you and I decided that we would look through some of the past pets in the White House.
Yeah.
The Trumps didn't have one. We don't know why. I don't think they could find an animal that liked him, you know? So, I'll tell you what we're going to do here. I have a, I've got a nice piece of music here. You ready? This is, it's called Blue Jay Way. I don't think a blue jay was one of the pets. All right, we go back to President George W. Bush. He had a Scottish Terrier named Miss Beasley. He had an English Springer named Spot, who was the offspring of Millie, Barbara Bush's dog. There was a lot of inbreeding in any of these presidential families, so they had a cat called India, and they had a longhorn cow at the ranch. All right. Can you imagine Bush with a pet cow?
I could.
Yeah.
He's from Texas, so I can see him with everything else,
how
too.
How about Trump with a pet cow? He'd be out trying to milk a bull. All right. President Ronald Reagan. Remember this, Lucky, who was a Bouvier de Flandre. That's some sort of a breed there. Rex. Victory was a golden retriever. Peggy, I remember the Irish setter. And then he had all those horses out in his ranch. Again with the horses. Mm-hmm. You know. It was Reagan. All right, Kennedy. President John F. Kennedy. I remember this. His daughter had a... I think it was called Macaroni. She had a daughter. Yeah, Carolyn Kennedy's pony. She had a pony called Macaroni. And yeah, that was a great administration. And a rabbit called Zsa Zsa. So, yeah, I like that. President Kennedy, by the way, has a great quote that I was going to try to kind of dip in. He said, forgive your enemies, but remember their names. So we'll have that. That's next to the Macaroni portrait. All right. President FDR had a famous dog called Fala. He was a Scottish Terrier. MJ, you have a pet. You do not have a pet, do you?
I do not have a pet at the moment.
So just pick one as we go by here.
All right.
A Scottish Terrier would be good for you. How about Calvin and Grace Coolidge? Calvin Coolidge slept 12 hours a day, but he had time to have the following. Wow. Prudence Prim, a collie. Peter Pan, a terrier. Come on. Would you name your dog Peter Pan? I mean, you're just asking for trouble. Calamity Jane was a sheepdog. Tiny Tim was a chow. Blackberry was a chow. This guy's lived on a farm.
He had a zoo.
I know. And it goes on and on. It's like page two here. They had a Belgian Shepherd, a bird dog, canaries. Nip and Tuck. Nip and Tuck, the canaries. Do we have those for you? There they are. Snowflake, also a white canary. Old Bill, a thrush. A goose. They had they had a raccoon. What? Come on.
Bobcat.
A bobcat. They had a bobcat at the White House?
Yeah.
Wow. That makes sense of that. President Theodore Roosevelt. Now, he was an outdoorsman. He was a hunter and a fisherman. His favorite horse was called Blystein. I want to know what that is. He had the following horses: Renown, Roswell, named after a famous UFO sighting, Rusty, Jocko Root, Grey Dawn, Wyoming, and Yajinka, all horses. Then he had carriage horses. He had a Shetland pony. He had a Saint Bernard. I love those. This is the dog with the that keg of brandy around their neck.
Yeah.
Saint Bernard. Yeah. I think they come with that when they're born. He had another, a cat, Josiah, a badger, was the pet. Oh my God, wait, it goes on and on and on. It goes on and on and on. All right, I'll tell you what. President Grover Cleveland, he had a Cocker Spaniel and a Collie and a St. Bernard. He had Dachshunds, Foxhounds. He had Canaries and Mockingbirds. He had a French Poodle. I don't see it was a French poodle, by the way, MJ.
No.
I'm taking that off the list. You know. Rutherford B. Hayes had a Newfoundland dog. He had an English Mastiff called Duke. Grim, a greyhound named Grim. Huh? What do you think?
Not Grim, bad names.
Say what?
Not bad names.
Yeah. Dot, Juno, and Shep were a couple of hunting dogs. But at least these are sound like, you know, pet names. Mm-hmm. I mean, today there's all kinds of stuff that you've got. All right, President John Tyler had a horse called General, a pair of wolfhounds, imported wolfhounds. President Martin Van Buren had a pair of tiger cubs given to him by the Sultan of Oman, and Congress made him send them to the zoo. Wait a minute. President John Quincy Adams had an alligator. Hmm. You ever had an alligator? Eaten an alligator?
I have not. I heard it tastes like chicken.
It does taste like chicken.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like a chicken. That's one of the things. Anyway, the Congress made John Quincy Adams give it to the zoo. All right. And then finally, President Abraham Lincoln had a pet pig and a family dog named Fido. ponies belonging to Tad and Willie Lincoln, white rabbits, Nanny and Nanko, who were goats. Tad Lincoln's turkey was named Jack. Lincoln's dog was named Jip. You know, I probably read a couple of dozen books about Lincoln.
Yeah.
I never heard any of this stuff.
Really?
No. Was Jip the Lincoln dog? No. I think this is all. I don't know. Then he had a couple of cats. So, and then the last thing in this thing is, who took care of all these pets? Is a question mark?
Definitely.
And that's where the printing stops. So we just don't know. Charm of the Beatles to American ears, at least our young ones, was the accents. He shaved another customer. All right. Anyway, Magical Mystery Tour was released on this day in 1967. Some of our favorite songs are on that particular disc. This is a day in 1992 when the House of Representatives began to impeach Bill Clinton. Remember that? You'd forgotten about that. Remember that happening?
That was before
your time. Yeah. That was about Monica Lewinsky.
I heard about it. Did you? I never got the real details.
I'll explain that to you off the air.
Sounds about right.
All right. Jodie Foster's got a birthday today. Well, we could do a retrospective on Jodie's movies. I've got some stuff here for you. And let's see here. Finally, but actually not... Well, last but not least, Jack Dorsey has a birthday. Who's Jack Dorsey? Jack Dorsey is one of the people that founded Twitter. And are you interested in how they managed to do that? Let's send out a tweet right now. You ready?
Twitter today boasts annual revenues of over $2 billion. But how did it get there? Well, let's rewind. The company was founded back in 2006 by Jack Dorsey and a team from Odeo, a now defunct podcasting network. It allowed users to broadcast short updates, then limited to 140 characters. The first tweet was sent in March of that year. The service was and remains free to use, as Twitter makes its money through advertising revenue. In 2007, its popularity surged during the South by Southwest Interactive Festival, as attendees competed to get their words on screen at the conference venue. The number of tweets jumped from 20,000 to 60,000 a day. Fast forward to 2009, and it had an estimated 18 million active users, rocketing to 185 million by the end of 2012. The following year, the company held its IPO, listing on the NASDAQ at $26 a share for a market capitalization of more than $18 billion. Shares rose to $44 on the first day of trading, a sign of strong investor confidence in a firm which had yet to post a profit. It ended 2016 with more than 300 million active users, but growth appeared to be stalling, with the firm facing controversies over spam, extremism, and abuse, including concerns the platform facilitated Russian meddling in the US election. Some investors began to question if Twitter would ever post a profit, with its share price falling to less than $18. However, the company appeared to turn a corner in the following year, and it made strides towards improving the user experience. It improved timelines, increased the maximum tweet length, and clamped down on automated and malicious accounts. These changes helped Twitter boost engagement and advertising revenues, with the firm posting its first profit in Q4 in 2017. Its share price rose to over $33 in the week after the news was announced. What does the future, though, hold for Twitter?
Well, we could be sending stuff out. We actually have a Twitter handle here. It's bleat_network, which I never send stuff out, and I should. So if I did, we would probably be racking up the money right now. So Jack Dorsey with a big happy birthday. Should we send out a tweet right now? You ready? Let's do it. Okay. All right. That'll do it. You think? I need more sleep. It's called Blue Jay Way. That's one of those sort of get lost in the music songs that's on Magical Mystery Tour. An album that was released on this day in 1967, so lots of that going on here. Right now, in the present day, it's 23 before the hour. It's Pandemic Pirate Radio from Chicago on Bleat.network. You know, this has been an opportunity for us on the show to do something. We have a little abbreviation. It's S-O-T-T, something other than Trump. And it's given us, really given us an opportunity to just look at stuff that nobody was really paying attention to. For some reason, we started thinking about mushrooms on the show, and so far I've learned that the study of fungi, I think, is called mycology. As luck would have it, we have somebody that is a studier of mushrooms on the phone right now. His name is Brooke Reed. Hey, Brooke. Good morning.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm doing good. You know, people would tune in and see you're talking about mushrooms on the radio. But you're a mushroom. you are a mushroom guy. Not only are you a mushroom guy, let me see if I can pull this off. You are a mycologist. Is that right? Is that the right word?
I am leery of that term because I didn't. There is nowhere to go to school for that.
Really?
I got taken under the wing of some other people who are serious mycologists and got to learn from the best. And so. Some people refer to me that way now, but I am leery about it because there are giants who walk among us who study mushrooms far more intensely than I do. And so I'll take it, but let's stick amateur mycologist on the front of that.
I love this guy. You know, thank you for not taking a bow. Brooke Reed, and it's B-R-U-C-H.
That's right.
Yeah. How long have you been into mushrooms? I'm guessing a long, long time.
I grew up hunting morels and a few other species with my family, and it was a topic of conversation around the Thanksgiving and Christmas and Easter tables. And morels, as you hopefully know, don't really happen in Illinois or up here in Chicago until May, sometimes into June. So it was always a talk of the season past and the season to come, and do you think we'll get the moisture this year? Do you think that they'll come early? And then about, 20 years ago, this is a bit of a story, but I was gay country dancing.
Yeah.
And a fella asked me to dance, and I said, yeah, I'm actually leaving early. It's morel season.
Yeah.
And he said, what?
And you were...
The Illinois Mycological Association has a foray scheduled for tomorrow. Why don't you come along? And so I did, and I got hooked on not just the morels, but the many, many, many other diverse mushroom species that there are, not just to enjoy eating, but also just to know and study and beware. And that is how I got hooked.
I have no idea.
Patrick Leacock, the mycologist at the Field Museum, who then, when I moved to New York, hooked me up with Gary Linkoff, who wrote the Audubon Field Guide to North American Mushrooms.
Wow.
And I was with Gary and his New York Mycological Society for 6 years, and I learned a lot there. And then when I moved back 5 years ago, I hooked back up with Illinois Mycological Association, and I also became the executive secretary of the North American Mycological Association,
and this,
the umbrella group of all the mushroom groups.
And this all started with gay dancing, is what you're telling me, right? In the beginning of that? This is morels, man. You hit my button there, Brooke. I used to work in Iowa, WOC, and I went out there, and one of the first mornings that I was on the air, this fellow dropped me an email. You don't get this in Chicago so much, but this is, you know, a little bit smaller rural area. The guy says, you want to go hunting morel mushrooms with me? And I said, sure. What does that entail? And folks that don't know what that is, a morel mushroom, geez, Brooke, there's nothing sweeter than a fresh morel mushroom.
So good.
Yeah. So are you going to invite me to hunt? But this guy that I'm referring to, he almost like blindfolded me, right? Have you ever like gone to somebody who's like a fisherman? They have their fishing hole. This guy had his morel tree. So
yep.
It's a culture, isn't it?
It is. It's a subculture. And in particular with regard to morels, although different regions have their different favorite mushroom, and it's funny, in downstate Illinois, there's a divide between people who like morels and people who like what I call false morel, which is Gyromitra. But downstate, they call it Big Red. And Big Red is a complicated mushroom because it contains a potent carcinogen that's found in rocket fuel, but it's found in this mushroom naturally, called hydrazine. And so you're not supposed to eat Big Red. You're not supposed to eat Gyromitras. But when you fry them, they taste like bacon. And I don't think you can stop anybody from eating anything that tastes like bacon. And so in downstate Illinois, you will see people eschewing morels in favor of Big Red or the bacon mushroom.
See, I was expecting after this whole thing, you would give me a big warning, so don't eat those. But you're like, they taste good. What the hell?
But people do. I mean, yeah.
It
builds up in the system, and it's dangerous. You're not supposed to eat them. There have been a lot of poisoning cases.
Yeah.
Of people actually ingesting the stuff when they cook it. They don't cook it in a well enough ventilated area, and they breathe it in, and they get in trouble.
Jeez.
But other people manage to eat them just fine, and I'm up here. I eat morels.
Yeah. All right. That's good. This is Brooke Reed, who's suffering from some gastrointestinal disease right now. Brooke, you and I have never met, but I'm ready for us to go cook together. Do you, in fact, cook? You sound like a cook.
You know, I do, actually. I sort of fell into it on these big forays when nobody else wanted to. And I have a few cooking jobs coming up from a foray that I did in Wisconsin last year that they just want me to come to their museum event and just cook mushrooms, which is fine.
Wow.
I'll be happy to do that. I cooked a flight in Wisconsin of 12 mushrooms just to taste, some of which we knew were edible, but nobody ate them, and it was real interesting.
You're blowing me away here. I know that you're one of your many titles. You were the foray co-chair, so yeah. A foray is an expedition to get mushrooms, yeah?
Right.
I'm not as smart as you might have thought. I'm trying to work with this, but it looked to me like that.
Well, you like mushrooms, so automatically you're bumped up there.
So you went into Wisconsin. Tell me about, I know a little bit about Wisconsin. So you had a flight of mushrooms. I've never heard that before. We've had beer flights and ouzo flights and stuff like that. But you had a mushroom flight. Where did you get 10 different varieties of edible mushrooms in Wisconsin, if I may ask?
Well, we were up in northern Wisconsin in the Shawamiga-Nicolet forest area.
Oh man, I love it up there. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there were a dozen of us and everybody collected mushrooms, and honestly I had to pick and choose. I probably had 40 species that I could have eaten there, but I needed enough for 20 people to taste each one. And so I had to pick and choose the ones that I had enough of to cook. There's a lot of mushrooms that people don't know and are delicious edibles, and that's why when I hear somebody say I don't like mushrooms, I think You probably only mostly had the store-bought ones, or cream of mushroom soup, which I think is nasty. And those store-bought ones are, there's nothing really wrong with them as long as you cook them.
Yeah.
You cook them, because they also contain a carcinogen called agaritine that is destroyed upon cooking instantly, but to eat raw mushroom from the store is a very bad idea.
So going back, again, I'm in the forest with you here, Brooke. Do you have pictures of the bad mushrooms? Can you look right before I put it in my mouth?
In our pockets now on the phone, but mostly learning the bad mushrooms is a function of the people who've taught them to you by bringing them to the ID table over and over and over again, and you seeing them in the woods and pointing them out and saying, "Is this deadly Gallerina? Is this destroying angel?" And hearing the horror stories about people who've eaten this or that, the wrong boleate, and had a night on the toilet. But I don't carry pictures around, but I know and will point out every poisonous mushroom I see, both for my own benefit and in hopes that people that I'm with will learn them, because that is important. And you really do want to be careful, because the bad mushrooms are bad, and people die
yeah.
from them.
Well, so,
don't take risks. We don't take chances, and neither should anybody else. You have to know every mushroom you ingest or feed other people.
You know, it almost seems like you need a license. You know, I'm serious. You know, are you a sushi guy at all? I don't know if you eat sushi.
There's, I like sushi.
All right. There's a thing in Japan called a blowfish. And
yes.
You know about that? And the blowfish has to be, you have to be licensed as a Japanese chef to serve a blowfish because part of the fish is poisonous. And people like the blowfish because once they take the poison out, I know you know all this, Brooke. Once you take the poison out, there's a little bit of like, a little bit of it left in that. I don't know, for people that are looking for an unusual experience. Anyway, so you got to be licensed to serve blowfish. And I'm thinking that we almost need a mushroom foray license. But basically, you do that.
Basically, what gives you the license, as it were, is hook up with your local mycological association. We have the good fortune of having the Illinois Mycological Association right here in Chicago. IllinoisMyco.org is their website.
And we're going to put a link up on our website. So if you're driving, you don't need to go crazy. All right, go ahead.
So during the season, they go out every weekend or every other weekend to different spots, and it's everybody who shows up heads into the woods or the terrain and picks at least one of each mushroom they see and brings them back to a big picnic table or ID area, and knowledgeable people identify the mushroom, including its Latin name and hopefully common name, and also any uses or poisonousness that it may have. And you hang out with these smart people who actually know the mushrooms over and over again, and you pick it up. There are also some excellent books, including that Audubon Field Guide to North American Mushrooms that I just mentioned. I was just part of editing a book on the Amanitas, which is the Alice in Wonderland mushroom, but also contains the Destroying Angel and all the deadly Amanitas, the Death Cap. And that is by Britt Bunyard of Fungi Magazine Press, and that's a good one if you really want to know poisonous mushrooms well, because there's a lot of poisonous Amanitas.
What about drugs in mushrooms? We don't have too many secrets. I took some, whatever that's called, many, many years ago. They did work. If you listen to me, folks, please don't do it. The guy on the radio said I could. No, I didn't. But I'm just telling you for background, there was an era when people did some hallucinogenic mushrooms. And I think that's part of the culture. But what about that? I won't ask you if you ever had. I don't want to know and ask you on the air. But
I'm not shy about it.
Go ahead.
I have, and I've used them 4 times in my life. And I'm actually I'm totally open about that, because I think that that mushroom, it's not just a drug just to have fun with, although that was the first experience I had. Those mushrooms are a sacrament that I think every thinking adult should have access to. And, in fact, they've been decriminalized and or legalized. Oregon just legalized
them. Yeah, they did. Yeah.
And the reason for that is that, in particular, people with end-of-life diagnoses and other mental health diagnoses are attaining amazing benefits, clinical benefits from using these mushrooms to live better the rest of their years or months that they have. It reorders the brain. It has been proven to grow new brain cells in adult organisms. And I have been around a lot more people than I have tripped myself. I mean, I've done it 4 times in my life. Three times in college, and then 23 years went by, and then I did it 4 years ago. And I am an advocate of them. Unfortunately, they don't grow around here, except in people's closets and jars. I do not grow them, for the record.
All right.
But I am an advocate of that, and I just think that it's an adult thing you should do in a natural setting with people you love or are comfortable with, and you learn amazing things about yourself. And there's also a lot of people doing this microdosing, which is taking a subclinical dose of one or two small dried caps a day for a period of 10 or 30 days, and gradually that lifts people out of depression. Now, I'm not a clinician. I'm not a doctor. I'm repeating what other people are doing.
Yeah,
I'll jump in there.
I know somebody that microdoses, and I think that it probably works for some people. And I, yeah, it's cool. No, it's cool. Hey, you know what? We're adults. We're adults.
Yeah.
We're adults. I've heard about the microdosing. And back to, you know, the whole cultural part of this. I know that you know what peyote is. Peyote is a thing that grows on a cactus. And that's part of a religious thing that's been going on for a zillion years.
So were the mushrooms. I mean, we got our use of the mushrooms from the 1950s. This white guy, Gordon Wasson, went down and met with a shaman named Maria Sabina, or that's what she went by, in Mexico. And her tribal identity was... the shaman who used these mushrooms, among other holy substances. But that's where the psilocybin mushroom in Western culture became a thing, at least in North America and Western Europe. Although there's a tradition in Europe of using Liberty Caps and other quote-unquote magic mushrooms as well. Huh. But the main consciousness of psilocybin mushrooms comes from Gordon Wasson, who was on the cover of Life magazine promoting his experience with Shaman Maria Sabina, a Mexican lady, and her use of mushrooms for ceremonial purposes.
Hey, before I let you run, my producer, Natasha, says they're making furniture out of mushrooms. You know what I'm referring to?
Yeah, that's true. There's a lot of people doing a lot of interesting things with mushrooms, making meat substitutes and construction materials. And I don't have firsthand experience with that, but if she's interested in people who do that, I can hook her up with somebody to talk to. But yeah, mushrooms, the chitin that forms the mushroom, which is actually indigestible until you cook it, so another reason, don't eat raw mushrooms.
Yeah.
Just don't.
I haven't thought about it. Hang on.
You can grow it through a substrate and then harden that in a kiln or other, you know, a chemical process, and have a super, super sturdy yet ultimately biodegradable material.
So you you don't even if I go to the Jewels here in Chicago,
yep,
and I get fresh mushrooms, you don't recommend eating those.
That's not true. I totally recommend eating them. Just cook them.
Yeah, cook them. Okay.
Don't eat them raw.
No, that's what I meant. No, that's what I meant.
Great mushrooms at Jewel.
Because people, I know what you're talking about. This is a tricky one, Brooke. I don't want to be up on charges tomorrow. All right. I hear you there. Wow. I said yesterday, sometimes you look in a box and you don't know what's in the box, and you find something that was even better than what you thought was in the box. I think that would apply to you. This is Brooke Reed. Listen, you'll be up on charges tomorrow. So we want to make sure that you come back and see us. It's Brooke Bruch Reed Reed, and you can go to the Illinois Mycological Association, which has a website, and we'll put that on our bleat.network that I, along with some other stuff. All right, he's the 4A co-chair. And he and I are going to be, we're going to be hunting morels together.
All right.
All right.
I'll take you out.
Okay.
They won't be around until about May. Look me up and I'll take you out. I'm not shy about, I don't protect my spots.
Yeah.
A mushroom is an event that happens to the right person at the right time. And if I can put other people onto mushrooms to find themselves, that's one of my favorite things in the world. I have found a lot of mushrooms in my life. It's your turn.
You sound kind of promiscuous.
Well, I didn't say what else I did in the woods.
We'll leave that for the next show. It's Brooke Reed. Thank you, man.
My pleasure. You take care.
Have a good day. Wow. How about that? MJ just came in. What do you think, man? Mushrooms, yeah?
Yeah, I love mushrooms, actually.
Yeah. It's culture. It's eating and ingesting and taking, and that's a cool thing. I really enjoyed that. We'll talk more about mushrooms. Yeah, wow. The day has flown by today. You know what I was going to do? In fact, we got time to do this. you know, in this era of the president and what's going on in leadership, this is the anniversary of the Gettysburg Address done by Abraham Lincoln, who wrote it apparently on the back of an envelope, if you can imagine that, you know. Trump's stuff, you know, appears like it was written on the back of an envelope, but, you know, Lincoln actually did that for real, so.
My sixth grade teacher made me learn it.
Is that right?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. She made us learn it. It was a part of our social studies.
All right.
Fine.
So they had a, they had, this was of course to dedicate this cemetery. They had a famous orator of the day. His name was Edward Everett. He came up and he talked for like 2 hours. And and then Lincoln showed up. Here's Jeff Daniels. Or wait a minute, maybe this is you. No, yeah, we have a recording. It's either MJ or Jeff Daniels as Lincoln.
47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here, dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. That we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. That this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom. And that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
And there you go. For Natasha Rodriguez and Microphone Jones and Abraham Lincoln. See you tomorrow.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white. The bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry. Watch them grow. much more than I ever knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself.